The time is May 1991, where Bruce Willis plays a wisecracking cat burglar just out of prison, dragged back into a life of crime involving Da Vinci inventions, world domination, and an ongoing gang of cappuccino withdrawal. One minute he's stealing priceless art while singing Bing Crosby and K-Star mid-heist. The next he's dodging explosions and psychotic cartoonish billionaires with a taste for the Renaissance and power. This is a 90s goofy action comedy on espresso with a side of cartoon anarchy. So chaotic you may not know what's happening. And given the box office results, audiences didn't actually get what was happening. This week on the show, we discuss the 1991 cult classic, Hudson Hawk.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
This is my year, 1991, where it was an imagination for kids. Just a couple of months prior, we had If Looks Could Kill. We had these goofy, silly heroes, these goofy, silly, cartoonish villains. This is one that is one of my go-tos if I just want to turn something on. This is something I take away from each and every viewing, just out of the pure chaoticness of it. This, I've been waiting to have this conversation on this film, on this show, because this is one that wasn't meant for critics, just like If Looks Can Kill to an extent. This is pure silliness. It's absurd. It's just ridiculous. And I absolutely love every single second of this movie.
Yeah, this movie is a litmus test, like many movies we've had on the show. I'll put this in the same realm as Cabin Boy, Cop and a Half. I just had Craig McNeil, the Craig and Friends podcast, on my show, and he was just ecstatic that we covered Cop and a Half because it's a like underrated favorite for him, and he was looking for guests to do it on his show, and no one would do it, and he finally found somebody. And he was like, you beat me to the punch. You guys did Cop and a Half. It's like such an underrated classic. And he's right. It is. Just like this is. But again, this is not for everybody. This was certain people's cup of tea, and other people's definitely was not their cup of tea. What I will say about this is, I think you had to be in that age at the right time of the right year when this came out to really appreciate it for what it is. Because much like Last Action Hero, it captured the magic of, let's say, like you said, cartoonish humor, but also this idea that we're not taking our action stars so seriously. And that's what people didn't like about Last Action Hero when it first came out. And it's definitely not what people liked about this one. They're like, where is our hunky, handsome, serious, but slightly wisecracking Bruce Willis? This is a cartoon character, and this is a live-action cartoon. That's exactly what it is, and it's exactly why it works for me. Now, there's problems with it, problems with production. We'll get into that. But this is definitely, like I said, the line-in-the-sand movie for people in the 90s of, do you like Hudson Hawk, or do you hate Hudson Hawk? And I'm on the like-it side.
No, it reminds me. I remember watching Letterman around 91, 92, and Bruce Willis was on, and I was watching with my brother. And again, Letterman full of adult jokes. I couldn't even grasp, but I laughed. And my brother says, you don't even know what you're laughing at. It doesn't matter. It's the energy. And Bruce Willis brings the energy. And that's what the fun factor is. And this is what it brings. Most of it doesn't make sense. The dialogue is so sporadic, it doesn't make sense. But the energy makes you engaged. It makes you engulfed into what's going to happen next. It's one of those chaotic comedies mixed in with a lot of just action in the background. So to me, I think this one really does shout. It doesn't have to make sense because the cast brings it all. You have sporadic dialogue that just, and I think this one is my go-to where I have to really go back and listen. My rewatch this week, I picked up on lines that really didn't make sense to me the previous 12 viewings I've seen of this movie, but it's starting to make sense. And that's where it really brings a rewatch value to this, is that there's always something new you're going to take away from this. Even if you didn't like it the first time, you're going to kind of gradually get into it if you just give it a chance. And I think that's what people saw when this went to video cassette, is that it is rewatchable, sticking in that VHS and watching it over and over again instead of just buying the singular ticket and saying, I don't get it.
I mean, I'll one-up you on that. I watched it all the way through, and then I watched it again with the director commentary by Michael Lehman, who directed this. He directed Heathers, Meet the Applegates, and then Airheads with Brendan Fraser, Adam Sandler, and Steve Buscemi. So he definitely has a style, and his style is non-realistic, right? He's definitely whimsical. There's almost like a surrealist quality to his filmmaking, and this might be like the apex of that, where, first of all, this is a vanity project. Like, this is kind of Bruce Willis's idea. He created this character, and then Steven D'Souza, who wrote the Die Hard movies for him, kind of fleshed it out with Robert Kraft. But a lot of the zingers and one-liners, they all come from Bruce Willis. The idiosyncrasies of this character, the sunglasses, the hat, the crazy tuxedo, the cappuccino addiction, the singing the songs to Time Robberies, all these great little quirky ideas were all kind of like Bruce Willis's ideas of how cool he wanted to be in a movie of his own, and then it was fleshed out by these screenwriters. But also it reeks of studio interference and probably a disagreement in production between the director, the writer, and Bruce Willis. And when you listen to that commentary, that's exactly what it is. Michael Lehman apparently is a very chill director. It's like, okay, Bruce, if you want to do it this way, we'll do it your way, and then we'll fix it in post. So there are a lot of things like editing opportunities, structure, pacing. There's a lot of mismatched eyelines, but I think the reason why it works is because we live in a world in this film that doesn't match our reality. It's a hyper-realistic reality because it is a live-action cartoon, and that's what makes you forgive all the weird little physics questions that our critics have later. It just works on that level. If you look at it as like a surrealist, abstract painting of a film, that's the best way to enjoy it. Because if you're looking for a straightforward action flick, which that's kind of how it was marketed, you're definitely going to be let down. But listening to the filmmaker, like, as much as the issues were with the production, he loves the final product. And he was so surprised that it was lambasted by critics and that the audiences didn't show up to the theater, because Bruce himself liked it. It was his story. So it is a thing where the people behind this movie loved what it was, loved what they did, and the audiences just didn't show up. And it's one of those great question marks to me of like how that could happen to a film like this.
You're going
to
go abstract. You're going to go with that factor. I'm going to go one below that and say it's just a straight cartoon. You can almost visualize the editor coming out of the editing room with film all around him saying, what in the actual
fuck? A puff
fuck?
Of smoke
behind him. It's a Roadrunner cartoon. This isn't a painting. It's a Roadrunner cartoon. You get that from the cartoonish editing. You get that from the cartoonish transition shots, the way the cast really interacts with each other. Everybody here is a cartoon, from the villains to the hero. And that's what I think our problem was. And I would go back to it. If looks can kill, our hero was meh. Our villains were cartoonish. Here, there is not one character that isn't a cartoon or supporting a cartoon in the way they interact. And I think that's what the addicting thing is with this movie, is we go back to our inner child and we see that goofiness and we want to attach ourselves to this movie because it is just fun. Because between, whether it's on purpose or not, with the production issues, it doesn't matter. Because between the cast, the filmmaking, the direction, the writing here, I'm going to focus on for a second, because this is where I think it really does work, because Bruce Willis put his input on it. The writers put their input on it. The director probably did. This is where it is so chaotic and sporadic. We want to hang on to almost every word to try and just tag along with these characters on what the hell they're actually saying. So to me, I think this one really does shout cartoon, but for adults. And it's almost like an SNL skit where it is just so improvised almost that we can just kind of just have fun with it, go along for the ride, and not take it too seriously. You have a lot of these action comedies that really do try and zero in on that fun factor, and they fail. This one just says, I don't give a fuck. I'm going to go in, and I'm just going to have fun. The production's hell. Let's just do it. And the success of it is spot on.
You know, a couple years ago on The Cult-Worthy, you and I talked about an animated film, a cartoon, whose villains were a brother and sister team of aristocrats with a dog. And here we have the Mayflower family. We have Sandra Bernhard, we have Richard E. Grant, and Bunny the dog. They are essentially the live-action version of the villains from the Chipmunk Adventure, dog and all. And I don't know how I never made that connection, but watching it this time, I was like, oh my God, these are essentially the same characters. Sandra Bernhard's a Susan Tyrell character. Bunny is Sophie. They are rich people trying to get this magical treasure, right? And they are the main villains. And there's almost like this weird kind of incestuous quality to them. I was like, did these guys literally lift the villains from the Chipmunk Adventure? Because that's what it feels like. And I didn't hate it. I was excited because it just adds to the cartoon quality that you and I are championing about this film. Yeah, it's just great. And the casting, right? Like, all these characters are just straight out of a Mad magazine, straight out of a cartoon. They don't make any sense of why they're there. We've got the mob guys. We've got the weird FBI group with the Don Harvey and David Caruso and Lorraine Toussaint, named after candy bars. And James Coburn is their leader. For no reason, they don't add anything to the story other than color. And that is the best part about this movie, is these characters are all colorful. And they give Bruce Willis the most colorful sidekick of all time. They give him Danny Aiello, who is just right there with him, matching his faux blues man type energy, where he's going to like be able to, I always wanted to sing in a movie, and they're going to sing in a movie. Is it a musical? No. But is it approached like it was a musical? Yes. It breaks all the conventional rules of filmmaking and storytelling. And that's what makes it great. But also, that's why audiences didn't like it. And I feel like you and I are going to contradict ourselves as we defend this movie once we get to the critics, because essentially, this is the kind of movie where when you've taken the critic's side saying, hey, they are just trying to tell you, is this movie worth your time and worth your money? This is where we have to like put that subjectivity aside and be like, okay, my critic brain is off because I love this movie and I'd go pay $20 to see it in the theater right now. But can I really recommend it to an audience? It's going to be kind of that canary in the coal mine of how serious we are about our film criticism.
I would recommend this hand over heart because of the fun factor, because we have our two thieves that act like a dumbed down version of the Blues Brothers. And that's because of the musical concept of it. And I love the introduction of that music to really recognize the fun factor. And we have Bruce Willis spouting off the timestamps of these songs to do his heist. I wish I had more of that. That would be my big criticism of that, to make that seem relevant. But I think this movie really does point to success when we have David Caruso, that death scene at the end. Tell me, with the limited screen time these people have, that we didn't have an impact to these death scenes, to these characters towards the end. And that's how you know you're having fun, that you don't want these characters to go. That is successful writing. That is successful direction, that we feel for these characters, even though we know they're not any good. Our characters, especially the ex-CIA, whatever it may be, the candy bar gang, whatever you want to call them, every single one of these, they have a moment where we sympathize with them, where we kind of just relate to them to almost the fun level, not in the morality level, but the fun level. And we want to see where these characters are going to go. There's so much fun, we don't want it to end with these characters. And the Kit Kat scene killed me.
I think it's also really interesting, too, that Bruce Willis, coming straight off of these Die Hard films, said he wanted to play this character without weaponry, without technology, right? He's like, I don't want to have to be the guy with the gun. I want to be the guy that uses his wits. I want to be the guy that uses very, let's say, low tech and lo-fi equipment, almost like a gadget man. And that's kind of the brilliance of it, because it reminds me of when he did the voice for RJ the raccoon in Over the Edge, right? Where he's got his bag full of gadgets and toys and things that he's kind of modernized to make himself a more successful cat thief. They took that character right from Hudson Hawk. So it makes me feel like this is the real Bruce Willis. Like, this is the character that he's desperately wanted to play, the character that he created for himself and essentially rode that into like the decades ahead in the other projects that he did. Like, this is his character. It covers everything the man loves. The blues music, being able to sing, the one-liners, the zingers, the physical comedy. I mean, he literally does a back-and-forth kind of knocked senseless little cartoon antic in the big climactic fight at the end. And it's ridiculous, but I love it because no one is taking it serious. He is telling you, may as well be looking straight into the lens of the camera, this is a cartoon. And you just don't get many movies like this that really embrace how much this performer loves what he's doing. Because he's allowed to. He doesn't have to stay in character. He is allowed to show you how much fun he has. And his only expectation is that you have as much fun. And maybe that's the problem. Audiences just didn't know to have this kind of fun back then. In some ways, they still don't. Like, you don't. If you don't really know what the film is and what it wants from you as an audience member, and you go in expecting Die Hard, then you're not going to have fun with it. And maybe that's a problem. Maybe we as audiences are just too pretentious, and then we think we know better than the movie, and we got to let ourselves go sometimes to the experience.
Well, we kind of had this discussion when we talked about Oscar, where audiences weren't ready for the comedic level of it. We weren't ready for the Sylvester Stallone energy and chaos. This is where Bruce Willis does it right. I'm not saying Oscar was bad, because that was a phenomenal movie, but here, this was a passion project, and I love passion projects where they match the energy. If there was anybody else that just got casted in this movie, we wouldn't have seen that same performance. This is, I'm going to let loose, I'm going to do something different, I'm going to challenge my range, and I'm just going to be silly. You can take the worst possible script, and if you have that energy that we see from the cast here, it's going to take that movie up an octave to at least have the audience get in on the fun. And that's what this movie is letting the audience in on the fun. It doesn't make sense. We see the flaws and we don't care, because this is where Bruce Willis, if we take any Bruce Willis movie, this is the one that's going to be at top of mind, because this is him out of his element. This is him really committing to a role and putting him out of that comfort zone. And it's the most memorable, in my opinion. And I know that's going to be up for a debate, but this one, I think, really does challenge him, and not in a challenging way, but it does challenge him to go out of his shell of that action star.
I think this movie came out a few years too early. If it would have come out, let's say, mid to late 90s, after people like Jim Carrey and Adam Sandler start making these films that are just utter chaos and nonsense and ridiculous humor, but they're bringing in the big bucks and audiences are now, they've got a taste for that kind of humor, that kind of man-childish comedy, right? I think that this would have played better in that environment. But this being so early in the 90s, we're still in the realm of high action, high octane thrill pieces, erotic thrillers, right? A movie like this seemed so out of place. But put it in like 96, I think it would have done so much better, because people now had a taste for this kind of absurd comedy, and this would have been a lot more palatable. That's what I think when I was watching this. I'm like, 91 was a bad year for this. It wasn't that moment. I mean, Wayne's World hadn't even come out yet. And that kind of introduced us to like this new Saturday Night Live sketch comedy elongated into a feature length and getting us ready for more absurdist comedy. This just wasn't the right time.
Well, I think if it wasn't a buddy cop movie, it shouldn't have been an action comedy. That was a criteria, mm-hmm. I think. You had your buddy action cop chemistry that's a little bit fun, and that's what audiences were used to. Mixing action, goofiness, comedy. You're right. If this came out a few years later, this would have actually, I think, done well. Our viewers would have matured. They would have experienced a gradual introduction to this that wasn't the buddy cop comedy. So I think this one was ahead of its time. But at the same time, even if it came out in the mid to late 90s, how sporadic it is, it still would have been a gamble, but it would have had a better shot because I think viewers would have been used to more random humor. And like you talked to, the Jim Carrey, the Adam Sandler, even though they weren't in funny action movies per se, but it still is an evolution of the audience to prepare themselves for something they haven't seen before. And that's what we needed here is audiences to be mentally prepared for something different. In the 90s, we've seen it time and time again with movies. Audiences aren't ready at that time to pay a ticket for something different.
Yeah, I agree. Sometimes, you know, it's just the luck of the draw of when you put your movie out and what the mood for the audiences were. We talked about this in Carnosaur, right? If it was a cheesy dinosaur movie made before 1993, no matter what the budget, people would have been like, meh, you know? You needed Jurassic Park to happen for people to be able to accept that kind of concept. You needed Jaws to happen for people to accept killer shark movies. Because there were killer shark movies before Jaws, but they were terrible. They were Italian, European, and they made no sense, right? They weren't scary. They were almost laughable. So it does take the right movie at the right time to launch it. And Hudson Hawk, to me, I think is great because it is like this tchotchke of the early 90s that a lot of people either haven't seen because they refused to at the time and just put it out of sight, out of mind, or they gave it a try, did not like it, and never revisited it, never went back to it with the mindset of this is supposed to be fun. And I think that's why it is such a lost gem of a film, because only people who really know what it is and appreciate it are the ones that champion it and tell people about it and kind of keep it in the zeitgeist. Otherwise, it wouldn't have this fancy Kino Lorber Blu-ray with all these extra features, right? That was for us. Getting the special features behind the scenes, the commentary, that was for fans like you and me.
Well, I think those going into Hudson Hawk, if they were to watch it for the first time, this isn't, I'm tired, I'm going to turn something on. Oh, it's a Bruce Willis film. This is going to be something that I'm just going to relax to. This is one, honestly, be top of mind, be alert during it so you can actually grasp what it's throwing down. Second time around, yeah, throw back a couple of bourbons and have some fun with it. But the first viewing, you need to kind of just pay attention to what this movie really is. And you need to see the flaws to really appreciate this movie. And then take in the energy to really kind of get engulfed into this story that you're not going to get the first time. Nobody's going to get this story the first time. That's why you really have to go to a second time to say, did I really like this movie or did I have fun watching this movie? So that's the magic of Hudson Hawk, is that it's not a one and done. You have to give it a second viewing because you're going to appreciate it that much more.
Well, this was notoriously hated by our critics, so let's go ahead and hear what they have to say about it.
That's Bruce Willis as a whimsical master thief in Hudson Hawk, an overstuffed caper comedy in which, unfortunately, every character, I mean every character, including the villains, tries too hard to be funny. The result is a well-intentioned movie that tries to be different, but just wears us out. Willis plays Hudson Hawk, fresh out of prison, who, along with partner Danny Aiello, sings his way through a theft of a Leonardo da Vinci sculpture that contains part of an ancient machine that can transform base metals into gold. Hudson Hawk might have worked if only Willis and Danny Aiello, say, had been the silly ones and everyone they met was super straight. Also, the whole bit about the da Vinci alchemy machine doesn't work. The machine looks cheap, like out of some 50s children's film. Hudson Hawk does have some funny lines from Bruce Willis, but this project was ill-conceived, I think, right at the script level.
So I think it's really easy to say that as a critic because if he's looking at it at face value, yeah, that is kind of what it is. Everyone is overacting because that's the kind of project it is. But, you know, our critics, if you're not taking yourself seriously as a film, they are going to shit on you. Even if you're a comedy, if you bring this absurdist wink at the audience nonsense to the show, they're going to shit on you. And that's exactly what they do. And this is the thing also that we didn't mention. The whole Da Vinci subplot is an obvious plot device and a MacGuffin. It really has nothing to do with what the movie really is. It is literally just a plot device to get us from A to B. And speaking of plot device, the new Naked Gun remake, that was my favorite joke in the movie because it literally did what this movie did. It just gave you this big, ridiculous thing that means nothing. It's just the catalyst to get our characters going, and then they'll maybe touch on it at the end. But really, it is the driving force of starting the movie. It doesn't need to be dissected. It doesn't need to be critically analyzed. It doesn't mean anything. It is just the MacGuffin. It is just the plot device. And that pisses me off that he's actually going to ridicule that when it literally has nothing to do with what this movie is.
Well, I analyze the hell out of the Naked Gun. Well, but this is where it kind of borderline slapstick, right? Because slapstick is going to be an acquired taste. It's not always going to land with everybody. And this walks a fine line of that. And this is where I think Gene is confused, where he won't accept it, that this is just goofy. And the plot, you're right, it doesn't matter. You have just milestones in this movie just to put Bruce Willis in situation over situation. I mean, you have him in what, New York, then Rome. It's just milestones to get him through the next situation. And that's where our critics aren't going to appreciate that, because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't really add up. And that's okay, because this one tends to go for the more goofy, unrealistic fantasy. This is one where you have Bruce Willis in, you know, a get up with a top hat, glasses, always wearing black. He's almost like a kid fantasy superhero, where it's one of those that you want to look up to because he has a cool factor, but he's a villain at the same time. So it's one of those that critics aren't going to grasp that, because you need to have a straightforward hero, villain, nothing in between. It needs to make sense. And the comedy needs to be straight to my face. And the comedy here isn't straight to the face. It's really subtext. And a lot of audiences, I think, weren't ready for that, including our critics. When you have the action genre mixed in with comedy, it has to be apparent. And that's not what this is. That's why the rewatch value is so special.
No, this is definitely one of the most rewatchable movies of the 90s. And you know what? We should look into that. The rewatchability of this decade, the movies that I have probably seen more times than anything else, even in the theater, was this decade. There's just something about these movies that came out that, whether it's with like your frat boyfriends or the people that you grew up with or your parents, you can watch these movies on repeat and repeat and repeat because they don't demand your attention or respect. You could literally have it playing in the background, but you know exactly what's going on because you've essentially memorized the movie. This is one of those movies to me. And this is that decade where it's like, okay, I don't need to grow or learn from this film. I don't need to be educated. I don't even need to be entertained. Just make me have fun. Just let's have fun with this. It doesn't have to mean anything. And these guys are always looking for meaning. Roger especially, because he jumps in here.
It was. In fact, it's unbelievable that anyone could have read the script of this movie and thought that it could be produced as a successful film, because every single line starts from zero and gets to nowhere. It's one of these movies where there's no way for the audience to get involved because everything is arbitrary. The speech we just heard by James Coburn, I don't know what that was about. I don't know what it meant, and I don't know why it was supposed to be funny. I also didn't like the fact that throughout the movie, people would jump out of windows, and instead of being killed, they would land in chairs, sitting next to somebody would start talking to them. People turn up coincidentally, without any explanation, on two different continents, to the point where you're just sitting there feeling whoever made this movie was completely addled. There was just absolutely no window for the audience to get in through, to get into the story. Well, we're kept out of it.
Again, this is a lack of fun. This is not understanding what the movie is doing. Being a live action cartoon, breaking the rules of physics, breaking the laws of scene transitions in movies. And they do it so blatantly. It's a slap in the face, and that's what makes it fun. is that the movie is literally poking you in the eye with its jokes, saying, I dare you to take me seriously.
Well, we talk about intent on this show, and this one, the intent couldn't be more clear. When you're falling off of a roof and falling in a chair perfectly timed in the mobster's apartment or whatever, come on, that is so obvious on what it's trying to do. It doesn't need to be that clear. And this is where I have to agree with Roger to an extent. On paper, this probably looked a lot different than what we saw. But the intent of the filmmakers and the creative minds behind it, including Willis, kind of just pivoted it and just said, this isn't going to work in plan A. Let's go to plan B and just make it silly. Let's make it obvious that this is just going to be ridiculous. And it baffles me that the two critics that we find watch movies every week, 3 to 4 to 5 each week, can't see what the intent is to this kind of movie. The filmmaking is absolutely apparent on what it's trying to do. The energy is apparent on what it's trying to do. So, it again, this is one of those Siskel and Ebert reviews that baffle me, that they skip the intent, skip what it's trying to do, and skip the entertainment value of it, and just go, this is just stupid. And I get that humor is a taste, but you have to appreciate the intent of what they're trying to do because it is in your face.
You have to also respect the fact that the filmmakers are trying to take you on a journey. Like, they didn't have to globetrot. They didn't have to take you all over the world, from the States to Rome to a European castle. What about 90s comedies where they always have to end in some like gothic European castle? I digress, but they didn't have to do that. They didn't have to spend that money. It's the same as an Indiana Jones movie. They're trying to take you on a journey, a funny journey. They're going to take you across the world. They're going to pay your ticket for you, because that is part of the magic of movies, is they're going to take you to locales that you don't get to see every day. And they're going to throw these fun characters into these environments that you yourself would probably never end up in. It is movie magic. It's silly and it's fun, but it is exactly what people are supposed to go to the movies for. Escapism. Not to like have a serious message given to them through Hudson Hawk. Anyway, they finish up the conversation with this.
You know enough about the history of movies to know what kind of a style they're going for. They're mm-hmm. trying to do the Hope and Crosby routine. They're trying to do a little bit of Abbott and Costello. And they're trying to bring in all these kinds of things. And it's too much. It just doesn't work at all.
And I disagree. I think that we're in an era now where time tells us what people think of this movie. I know more people that like this movie, or dare I say love this movie, than I do people who don't, right? And the people that don't are people who are like my parents, or my parents' age and older, like these guys are. So politely disagree with their criticism. I think that Bruce Willis and company made a live-action cartoon for adults and below, and there's just a certain age gap that point and above did not get what they were trying to do.
This movie was made for our age at that time, between 11 and 16, give or take, because the humor, we don't necessarily understand everything at that age, but we can respect the energy. And as we grow with this movie, we understand more and more the more we see it. And you're right. This is one of those that, and the box office numbers show it, that adults didn't connect with. And this was targeted more for the adult age, with cartoonish villains and a cartoonish hero that nobody was expecting. So this one was a kid's movie with this cartoonish flair. And I think it helped it, because I don't think it would have been respected as much as it is now if it wasn't targeted, if it wasn't made with the intent of the cartoon aspect to really have kids just go wild with their imaginations with this movie of, I want to be that Bruce Willis character. I want to be Hudson Hawk. I want to go up against those cartoonish villains. It's an innocent enough, with a little bit of violence, an innocent enough film to really follow along, to spark the imagination of an action hero. So this is like Die Hard dumbed down with a lot of energy. And I related to the Hudson Hawk character more as a hero than I do some Marvel characters now.
Yeah. And it's definitely a relic of the videotape era, where it did better on cassette than it did in the theater, because it's a party movie. It is the kind of movie that you're going to put in with a bunch of people who either have or haven't seen it, and as an audience, as a group of wild people watching this wild movie, it works better than a critic sitting alone in a theater by himself on like a Monday afternoon, laughing or not laughing in complete silence of the theater because there's no one there. That's not the way to watch this movie. This is a party movie. It's like a Dr. Demento album. It's not fun to listen to yourself. Listen to other people so you can laugh at it. And that's my viewpoint. So, you know, neither of these guys liked this movie. And so when I rate my critic, I have to think about the justification that he's using in the terms of like, okay, well, I didn't find this funny. Is there anything redeeming about this movie to let me give it a thumbs up or a marginal thumbs up? And he doesn't. He doesn't find anything. All he wants to do is ridicule everything about it, from the leads, the performances, the characters that are too outlandish, the script that doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I guarantee there was barely a script. In fact, I listened to the commentary. There was barely a script. But I don't think you can write out the chaos that this movie is. I think that has to exist in creation in the moment, in the scene. A scene written on a napkin 10 minutes before they set up, right? That's what this movie is, and that's what it feels like, and that's what makes it unique. So I don't agree with Gene, even if he was trying to be like somewhat objective to the critique of like, well, maybe it's not my cup of tea, but audiences might like it. Doesn't even do that. So for that, I'm giving him a D.
Totally fair. And this one was a Gene-driven review, so Roger had very little input on this other than, I can't believe they put the script in front of filmmakers and somebody thought it was a green light. So that one doesn't tell me anything about this movie because, again, like we said, the intent is clear, the comedy is clear, the energy is clear and infectious. None of that is mentioned at all by Roger. And again, we've said it, laughter and comedy, it's for taste, right? But here, it's not even acknowledged that this is even a comedy to an extent. There is nothing that says anything from Roger and even to Gene to an extent to show what audiences are in for, to set this movie up for some sort of success because they didn't get the humor, without understanding that everybody has a different taste of humor. But they should, Roger, as smart as he is, should have at least acknowledged it was trying to do something different with flaws present. So I'm not going to give him anything higher than a one star on this one. I can't go beyond that because there is nothing that shouts, this is something some audiences with this particular taste might like.
And I think that we've like discovered a theme here where some of the lowest reviews we've given these critics, it's their critique of films that were actually received poorly by other critics as well, right? We're giving them a D and a one star on a movie that they gave thumbs down and most critics gave a D or a one star in their respectful papers. So I don't know. It's films like this, like I said, that contradict what we do on this show, because I'm not going to even say this is a guilty pleasure. I just like this movie. I have a blast with it every time I watch it, to the point where I will accept its flaws, and not only accept them, I am going to rejoice over them because they are what makes the film unique. And normally a conversation like this, if you didn't like this movie, that's the kind of viewpoint that I would have that you would like make fun of. Like, oh, look at you. You're going to give the film its laurels because it made you laugh at a guy who like tripped over a lighting C-stand. That wasn't supposed to happen, but you thought it was cute, so you're going to give it a thumbs up. No, we both like this movie. And so I think that is the difference between us and critics like Roger and Gene, is that we can take a step back from the pretentiousness of film criticism and just like something.
Well, I think this comes at a time in the early 90s where we crescendoed into the goofiness, right? And I think this is where they're actually coming out of the 80s thinking, I need to look for straightforward genres like action, comedy, drama. And whenever we kind of cross the lines between genres, they are extra critical and they don't have an open mind to it to see, does this kind of work? Is the intent there? They have full critics on of, is the writing there? Is the set design there? Is the music there? They're checking all the boxes, and they're just not giving into what the 90s was, which is just pure entertainment. Because we saw a ton of movies from the 90s that are just stupid, but we'll rewatch it over and over and over again because the studios at this point are going more for putting butts in the seats for entertainment value with stupid family comedies, some raunchy humor and all that. So that's where we're leaning to dropping all the writing, dropping the transition shots, dropping all the direction and character direction, and just going for the intent of having fun. And Hudson Hawk, I think, was the starting point other than, my opinion, If Looks Could Kill. But these are two unsuccessful movies that really did set the tone of stuff we wouldn't see later because of this unsuccessfulness of the box office here. But it did influence movies going forward when it comes to action in the 90s, where we did have a lot of those fun 90s movies that Roger and Gene actually did give into later in the 90s.
So Justin and I like Hudson Hawk, and I hope you guys do too. Well, we can scratch that one off the list. I still haven't really covered that one on the Cultworthy yet, so we actually beat it to the punch on this show. We might have to go into like a deeper discussion on that show eventually, but I'm glad that we got this out of the way. And there's a theme here. The film stars Annie McDowell, who is in the film that we'll be talking about next week. That's right. We unknowingly brought in an Annie McDowell double feature. My pick for next week is I am doing Hugh Hudson's Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes, starring Christopher Lambert, Ian Holm, and of course, Andy McDowell. A somewhat modern British aristocratic take on the Tarzan legend. But what do our critics think about it? And what do we think about it? So tune in next week for that. All right, everyone. So thank you for watching, listening. Please like, rate, review, give us 5 stars. Follow us on YouTube. Follow us on your favorite podcasting platform. You can find me, Antonio, over at thecultworthy.com. And you can find my co-host, Justin, over at
themoviewire.com.
Justin, I will see you next week and talking about Tarzan.
Can't wait. See you next week.